Okay, so Reim Tovim, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel. It's a pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler, who is going to present another one of, I'm sure, will be a fascinating series on the thought of Rav Soloveitchik as we approach another one of our holidays. We had him back before Rosh Hashanah and then before Pesach, Yom Kippur, so we look forward. Of course, Rabbi Adler was a very close Talmid of the Rav. He was his shamish, his personal assistant, and in his years at YU, driving around, taking care of the Rav, being very intimately close with him. And he just published a book. Maggie just published a book just a few months ago. It was seven, by Ibn Soharon, I believe, 70 Conversations in Transit with Rav Soloveitchik. Hot off the press, so it's a pleasure and to have Rabbi Adler back, and we've had him live in Toronto in person, and now we'll have to do it on Zoom, but a pleasure, and we look forward to the beginning of a three-part series on re-experiencing the Rav on Hanukkah. B'vakasha, Rabbi Adler.
Thank you very much. Tzaraim Tovim, good afternoon to all those on the East Coast, and Erev Tov, so everyone here in Israel, and I see some of our Yerushalayim friends. Indeed, we're having the three-part series, topics that our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, dealt with in various occasions. Tonight, we're dealing with the separating the story from the miracle of Hanukkah. Next week, it's going to sound like a little bit of an oddball topic of a bus of a fall of meat and milk and the Hanukkah candles, and has absolutely nothing to do with the kitchen and food preparation. It has to do with halacha and thought. And the last week we'll deal with the topic of divrei sofrim, the nature of mitzvot that are rabbinic in orientation, and how exactly the Rambam understands this. The Rav spent much time understanding the phrase divrei sofrim, and we'll try our best to give it over as well. So let's just begin with source number one. I'm going to put it up on the screen share for all of us to see. And here we go. We're up. Okay. Source number one from the Rambam.
Rabbi, I'm going to put it on our chat book. If you can make it a little bit wider, you have it just sort of on one half of the page. So if you make it wider, people can see it a little bit better.
You want me to do it? I'm not sure.
I can't do it on your computer. I'm not sure I can do it on my computer, but I for sure can't do it on your computer.
All right. Let me see.
But maybe one of our tech, our techies can tell Rabbi Adler how to best expand the sheet. In the meantime, I'll put it up in the chat box.
Okay. No, I'm not that computer savvy here. I'm just going to work with the pointer. And the title of the Rambam section is Rambam Hilchot Megillah V'Chanukah. Paragimel, and normally you don't start a topic in chapter 3, but in this particular case, the Rambam begins two chapters with the laws of Megillah, and to this end, we will deal with in the 2 weeks' time to understand the theme of a mitzvah that is Medivrei Sofrim, rabbinic in orientation, and why the Rambam fuses together or forges together the laws of Megillah with the laws of Hanukkah. So when he gets around to the laws of Hanukkah, two chapters already behind him, with the laws of Megillah. And it begins with a piece of history. The Bayit Sheni in the Second Temple era, Kishemalchei Yavan, Gazru Gzerot al Yisrael, when the Greek rule declared all kinds of restrictions on Am Yisrael, Batlu Datam, the religion was officially outlawed, Loiniku Otam Lasok B'Torah Mitzvot, we were not allowed to practice Torah and Mitzvot, Pashtu yadam bimemonam uvivnotehem, and there was much pillage in terms of both our possession and our daughters were taken. The commentators at Rambam tried to give various sources to back up these historic statements. Venichnesu leheichal, and the Greeks entered into the Beit Hamikdash. Partzubo pratzot timu ataharot. They created a scenario where that which was pure became impure. V'tzar lahem liYisrael ma'od mipneihem, and it was Am Yisrael was under sustained pressure, great difficulties. Lachatzum lachatz gadol, there was tremendous pressure on them. Ad sherichem aleihem alokei avoteinu, until the compassionate God had compassion on us. Hoshiyem mi'adam, delivered us from them. Hitzilam, we were saved. Gavru b'nei Chashmonai ha-Kohanim Abdulim, the Maccabean family, the Chashmonaim family, and it says Kohanim Gadolim. Does the Rambam mean that they were all in the status of Kohen Gadol? The Rabbi said that the Rambam means that they were great Kohanim. It just doesn't refer to the fact that one of them happened to have been the Kohen Gadol. But Kohanim Gadolim in this case is to be understood in a loose fashion. It's not the position of the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, but they were great Kohanim. They were great people. The Haragum, and they were able to kill off the enemy. Voshio Yisrael miyadam, and Am Yisrael was delivered from their hands. V'hemidom melech min ha-Kohanim v'chazram al-chut li-Yisrael yeta al-matayim shana ad ha-churban ha-sheni. And a king was appointed from the Kohanim Chashmonaim family, and the monarchy was restored to Am Yisrael for more than 200 years until the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. We have here a little piece of history in a very capsulized form, where, as we know, the Rambam does not write the Mishneh Torah for the purpose of writing a history book. And if he feels the need to put several lines down, a paragraph, halakha aleph, about history, apparently there's got to be some halakha embedded in the knowledge of the history. And he continues, we'll get back to this in a moment. And then he continues in the next paragraph, halakha bet, ukishigavu Yisrael alovihem, and when Am Yisrael were victorious over their enemy and beat them, it was the 25th of the month of Kislev. They entered into the Beit HaMikdash. And here's the story that we grew up as in kindergarten. They could not find a jug of oil or a canister of oil that was or that was pure oil, except one jar, pach echad. There was enough oil there for one day's lighting, bilvad. But what ultimately happened was they were able to light the nerot ha-maracha, the candles of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, shmona yamim, for 8 days, until the wine presses were able to produce fresh, the olive presses were able to produce fresh olive oil, shemen tahor, and fresh pure oil was then brought to Beit HaMikdash. So you have basically two paragraphs, one giving us the history and one giving us the miracle. And the fact that the Rambam puts it into two different halachot, it's not only because it just makes literary sense not to make a mishmash, a confusion between the historic background and the ness and the miracle of the pach shemen, of the jug of oil or canister of oil or jar of oil, but perhaps to teach us that we must necessarily separate the story from the miracle. There are two different things that are happening here. And when we do celebrate Hanukkah for the 8 days, there's a type of dual celebration that may be going on, perhaps even simultaneously. But it has to be understood as two different celebrations. And then the Rambam in the third paragraph says, "Umipneze," and because of this, now, remember the Rav emphasizing, because of all of this, there are some people who read, hitkinu chachamim shaboto ador, because of this, our chachamim instituted in that generation, shmonat hayamim ha'elu, that there will be 8 days, shetchilatan milel chamisha b'esrim b'kislev, 8 days that will commence with the 25th of Kislev, yemei simcha v'halel, days of joy and reciting of halel, we will light candles in the evening by the doors, the opening door of our house, each evening of the 8 nights, to somehow broadcast publicly and the idea of the miracle. They have a name these days, it's called Hanukkah. And they are forbidden on those days to eulogize or to fast, just like Purim. And the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles for 8 successive nights from the 25th of Kislev onward is a rabbinic mitzvah, mitzvah midivrei sofrim, no different than the reading of the Megillah on Purim. And I'm just going to anticipate something that we'll talk about in 2 weeks' time with regard to the Divrei Sofrim. The Rambam makes, in this case, two, but there is even a third connection between Hanukkah and Purim. This is not an accident. The Rambam did not have to tell us that the days of Hanukkah are forbidden with eulogies and fasting, just like Purim. And the mitzvah of lighting the candles is a mitzvah just like the reading the Megillah. And then he has a third statement further on in the Mishnah Torah. And there's no question that there's a message, a halachic message that the Rambam's giving here, but you're just going to have to tune in 2 weeks' time to get the full picture. I'm just anticipating. But I'm going back to the beginning of this third paragraph, halacha gimel, umibnezeh. There are those who read mibnezeh as just a direct connection to the second paragraph. The Rambam spoke about the miracle. And because of this miracle, the Chachamim ordained that there should be 8 days of Yom Tov that begin on the 25th of Kislev, and there should be lighting of candles, and so on. And the Rav was very adamant that mibnezeh does not necessarily go on halacha bet, on the previous paragraph only, but it goes on both paragraphs. Mibnezeh, because of all of this, because of the history and because of the miracle, that we now have a Yom Tov that will carry with it some duality in terms of the observance of the day. So you might read the following. Hitkinu, because of all of this, Hitkinu Chachamim Shavoto Ador, the Chachamim of that generation, did two things. One was that for 8 days, which begin with the night of the 25th of Kislev, Yemei Simcha V'Halel, that's the first thing. And the second thing is, there's going to be a mitzvah called lighting Hanukkah candles, and that will commemorate the miracle. So it is possible that the Rambam's alluding to the fact of Eddie in this third paragraph of the duality within the establishment of the Yom Tov of Hanukkah. Now, the Rav began by stating, again, having a piece of history in the Mishnah Torah, it seems to be somewhat superfluous because Mishnah Torah is not a book of history. But Rambam will include extraneous material, if you want to call it extraneous material, if it's germane to the understanding of the halakha. I'll give an example. In a very exaggerated case, in the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, establishing the new moon by judicial action, the Rambam spends more than 10 chapters pure astronomy, with all kinds of calculations, mathematical, and with drawings and so on, in order so that we can understand the astronomical basis of the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh. The Rambam himself, at the end, very apologetically, will say that, look, I included all this material here because I didn't want to send you to other books. And because this material is absolutely necessary for the understanding of the mitzvah in its practical sense, I had to include it into the Mishnah Torah. But it's not essentially a halakha. Would somebody be obliged to say Birkat HaTorah on those chapters of the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh where the Rambam talks about the astronomy? So I believe, according to Rabbi Professor Yitzhak Tversky, Zichron Lebracha, Rav's famous son-in-law, who was a big expert in the Rambam, he would say absolutely yes, that this part of science has now been incorporated as part of Torah. In the same way, we have here the history. And the Rav said that in the Hilchot Megillah, there was no need to write the history because we have Tanakh. We have Tanakh. And you open up the Megillat Esther and you get all the history. The Rambam will begin with the halachot of the reading of the Megillah. But an episode that takes place in the second Beit HaMikdash era after the canonization of Tanakh, so we don't have an authorized text. Now, there are books from the second Temple era, the Sfarim HaChitzoniim, the Book of Maccabees, Sefer HaShmoneim, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they're written by different authors, and they have different perspectives. One is more of the historical perspective, one focuses on the Beit HaMikdash, but they're not authorized Sfarim of Tanakh. And therefore, the Rambam feels that not everybody may have access to those books. In order to fully understand Hanukkah, it requires of him to give us a few lines of historical background. That's statement number one. Statement number two, says the Rav, that the full appreciation of the history becomes an integral part of the mitzvah of Hanukkah. And how is that expressed? So the Rambam uses the phrase that the Chachamim and that generation established for 8 days from beginning on the 25th of Kislev, Yemei Simcha V'Halel. And he says that we should be publicizing the miracle, and that becomes an important facet, to publicize the miracle. Laharot u'legalot hanes, to go public on this. And in the very end of the laws of Hanukkah, happens to be the fourth chapter, one of the last halachot, the Rambam says, mitzvat ner Hanukkah, mitzvah chavivah hi ad me'od. It's a mitzvah that's very, very precious. The Rambam, not just rarely, I don't believe he ever uses that phrase. He doesn't give out grades to a mitzvah, which is a beloved mitzvah, which is less beloved a mitzvah. The Rambam wasn't into romantic feelings here. Why is he talking about the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles as chavivahi ad ma'od, extremely beloved mitzvah? Tzarich adam lehizaher ba, you have to be careful, kedei lehodiya hanes, to publicize the miracle, ulehosif bishmach ha'el vodiya lo al hanisim shasa lanu, the miracles that God did for us, performed for us. And therefore, even if somebody doesn't have what to eat, but he just gets from tzedakah money, he should be getting oil and or candles to light for Hanukkah candles. It is extremely, extremely important mitzvah, and we don't want to leave anybody out in the cold in terms of performing this mitzvah. So the idea of publicizing, going lehodiya hanes ulehosif b'shevach ha'el, which paraphrases leharot ulegalot hanes, is something that's an integral part of the mitzvah. So much so that we will see shortly that if one lights Hanukkah candles in a place where you are not publicizing the miracle, in essence, you do not fulfill your mitzvah at all. You don't just get a half a mitzvah. It's just the incomplete mitzvah. So let's take a look at some of the sources first. So we have the Gemara, famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, excuse me, Daf Kaf Aleph, where the whole topic of Shabbat enters into the Gemara by piggybacking on the Perek of Bamem Avdikin of Shabbos candles. And because there's a suggestion that perhaps that which disqualifies, or the oil that may be disqualified for Shabbos candles, or wicks that may be disqualified for Shabbos candles, perhaps they're also disqualified for Hanukkah candles. And then there are various opinions that are offered. So through the topic of Shabbos candles, Hanukkah candles wiggles onto the page. And once it's on the page, so we get another three full pages about the laws of Hanukkah. And here the Gemara asks the question, my Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah all about? And I'll just interject that in the Baal, the Halachot Gedolot, which is a Geonic work from the 7th century, the Nusach, the version, or Girsa, is my Ner Hanukkah. It's not my Hanukkah, what happened? The Chachamim weren't asking us the historic question, what happened? The Chachamim were asking, why do we light the candles of Hanukkah? My Ner Hanukkah. And the question is, when we see the answer, which Girsa is more accurate? Did Chachamim ask the question, my Hanukkah, what is this Hanukkah all about? Or were they really asking, my Ner Hanukkah, why exactly do we light candles, where the assumption is we knew already what it was all about? So the Gemara tells us, the Tanur Rabbanan, a Braita, the Chafhei B'Kislev, on the 25th of Kislev, Yomei de Chanukah, 8 days of Chanukah, Tamnaya Inun, there are 8 days, the Lo Lemispat Bahon Ud Lo Litanot Bahon, no eulogies and no fasting. Now what language did I just read? It's clearly Aramaic. And not just Aramaic, but it's not the standard Aramaic that we may be familiar with in the Babylonian Talmud. This is the dialect called Eretz Yisrael Aramaic. And there's a difference between Aramaic of the Eretz Yisrael, Talmud Yerushalmi, and the Aramaic of the Talmud Bavli. And there's no surprise here. We know that if you're familiar with anybody who speaks Yiddish, if you would like to identify the background of a Yiddish speaker, and all you have to do is just listen to his Yiddish carefully, you will be able to conclude with great certainty that this fellow's family is from Poland, and this fellow's from Germany, and this fellow is from Lithuania, Lita, and you can hear it in the different Yiddish. This one's from Galicia. You can hear it in the Yiddish itself. So while the base language may be the same, but the articulation may be different, and the intonation may be different, and the vocabulary may be somewhat different, and the grammar may be somewhat different. And you have this with the English language as well in various parts of the world, even within the United States, and so on. I remember when Jimmy Carter was elected president of the United States in 1976. So in one of the TV news stations, they interviewed somebody from Atlanta, Georgia, and they asked him, so how do you feel having one of your own in the White House? And his response was, he said, it's high time we have a man in the White House who don't speak with an accent. So, you know, you have different states where they speak with different accents, and to them, that's called not speaking with an accent. If you come from the northern states, you hear that as a heavy southern accent. You have this also with Aramaic. And hence the source is Aramaic Eretz Yisraelit, and that's important because we know where this statement comes from. Tanu Rabbanan. This does not come from a source of Braita like the Tosefta that we might normally see a Tanu Rabbanan, but it comes from a book called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit is a document that was written several years before the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash. Essentially, it's a calendar, and it's a calendar of those days that is forbidden to fast. So I would call it Megillat Anti Ta'anit. And so it has Chagim, it has Yomim Tovim, many, many Yomim Tovim. There is even a second version of that that includes some fast days as well. But most of the days that are listed in the Megillat Ta'anit are days that we do not fast and do not say eulogies. What happened ultimately to the book of Megillat Ta'anit? The Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, and for those Daf Yomi people, you may have seen it just about 2 weeks ago. The Gemara says that after the second destruction, Botla Megillat Ta'anit Chutz Mechanukah V'Purim, the entire validity and force of the Megillat Ta'anit became abandoned because they were no longer relevant. But two of the Chagim survived the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, and they are Chanukah and Purim. So Chanukah and Purim we still have today. They're both mentioned in the Sefer Megillat Ta'anit. All the other fast day, all the other Chagim, all the other Yomim Tovim that it would be forbidden to fast or to say eulogies, these were Chagim that were based on political / military victories. And after the destruction of the Second Beit Midash, it became useless to continue celebrating and observing those types of festivals. I'll just digress for a second. In the 1970s, there was an article in Tradition from the Rabbinical Council of America where some rabbi suggested what would be the fate of Yom HaTzma'ut if, God forbid, the state of Israel went under. Would we be continuing observing Yom HaTzma'ut? Or perhaps the state of Israel continues, but we would lose Yerushalayim. Would we continue celebrating the 28th of Iyar as Yom Yerushalayim? And his thinking was that if the reason for these Chagim no longer are apparent, then perhaps the Chagim themselves would go under, just like those festivals that were mentioned in the Megillat Ta'anit that became irrelevant. I can tell you that in the subsequent issues of Tradition, there was massive letters to the editor basically yelling at that rabbi for having the audacity to even suggest a day without Medinat Yisrael in our hands and Yerushalayim in our hands. That he felt that people were writing that this is a weakness. How can you even suggest it? To use the Gemara phrase, how can you even have a hava amina, a thought that this would be the situation, and to discuss what would be the fate of Yom HaTzmut and Yom Yerushalayim. So this rabbi was under severe criticism just to raise a theoretical issue that really has basis in the fact that Botla Megillat Ta'anit, that most of the Chagim were abandoned after the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash, but Chanukah and Purim survived. So this is a quote, and being that the source is Eretz Yisrael in the time of just shortly before the Churban, the Aramaic is Aramaic of Eretz Yisrael. Yomei De Chanukah, the days of Chanukah, 28 days. How many days? Tamnaya Inon. They are 8. And I'll just say that the word shmona, eight in Hebrew, in Aramaic, the shin becomes a taf. So shmona is tamnaya. And in modern Hebrew, when we say a mituman, we mean an octagon. And when we say, we use the phrase tamnun for an octopus. This phrase in Aramaic has now been incorporated into modern Hebrew, denoting the number of eight. So then the Gemara goes up, the Gemara itself, after quoting from the Megillat Tanit, it actually goes over to Hebrew, which is the Hebrew of the Mishnah. When the Greeks entered into the Beit HaMikdash, they defiled all the oils that were there. And when the Maccabeans were victorious, but they searched and searched, and they only found one jar, that still had the seal, and therefore it was not defiled. They only had oil for one day. The miracle occurred. We know this story. The 8 days it burned. In subsequent years, it was established that these days would be days for Hallel and Thanksgiving. Now Rashi tells us that Hallel is the saying of Hallel that we do on Hanukkah for all 8 days, successive 8 days. And Hodaya is what we add ala nisim, both in our Shmona Esrei, our Tfilah, and in Birkat HaMazon. And it's interesting that with regard to ala nisim, the Rav said something phenomenal, that if you look at the ala nisim, if we're already mentioning something about language, it's written in the Hebrew of our Chachamim. We call it the Hebrew of the language of the Mishnah. Alanisim, except there's one word that's Aramaic, Purkan. We know the word Purkan. Shabbat before Musaf, we say Yikum Purkan Min Shemaya. The word Purkan means a help, a salvation, and we say Kadosh Baruch Hu should send us the help from heaven. Here we have the whole text in Hebrew. If I just put parentheses around the word Vala Purkan, it's all Hebrew. Alanisim. Vala chuot niflaot milchamot shasita laboteinu bayamim ahem bazman hazeh, all the wonderful things and that you did for us in these days. Why is there a word in Aramaic? Why does it say vala purkan? The Rav said something very, very interesting. He said that the word that's missing, conspicuously absent in the version of the Al HaNisim, is the word geula, redemption. It's not there. It says Ala Nisim, the miracles. It should have said Ba'ala Gulot. There were redemptions. There were things that went on here that were very redemptive. And then Ba'ala Chuot, Ba'ala Milchamot. It would continue in Hebrew. But Chachamim did not want to use the word Gula except for two specific occasions. One was the Exodus from Egypt, Gula, the Yitziyat Mitzrayim. That's a Gula. We celebrate it on Pesach night. And the final Gula, the final redemption. There we use the word Gula. Now, Kadosh Baruch Hu came through for Am Yisrael many times between Yitziat Mitzrayim and the coming of Mashiach. So what are they if they're not Gula? So the Rav suggested that the Chachamim used an Aramaic equivalent to show that it's not really a Gula. It's something, no doubt, and we have to observe it and celebrate it and so on, but it's nothing more than a Purkan, but it's not a Gula. And he said it with regard to Hanukkah and Purim, because both Hanukkah and Purim are anchored into specific historic context, and a good reason why we continue to celebrate it till this very day, but it's not something that spells out the ultimate Geula. That's going to be in the future, reserved for the future. So you have Ala Nisim, Ala Purkan. So Rashi says, the Hallel Behodaya is Hallel that we say in davening in the morning on the days of Hanukkah, and Hodaya is Al Anisim. What's missing here? The Shana Acheret Kavum Vasum Yamim Tovim. What happened to the Nerot? What happened to Hadlakat Nerot Hanukkah? That should be an integral part of this statement. And in subsequent years, the days were established as Yamim Tovim, the Hallel, the Hodaya, the Hadlakat Nerot. And then the opening of the Halachot Gedolot would have made a lot of sense. My Ner Chanukah. But that's not our version, as printed in the Talmud Bavli, it says, my Hanukkah, what exactly happened on Hanukkah? And this led the Rav to suggest that perhaps the idea of lighting Hanukkah candles was not part of the original institution of the Yom Tov of Hanukkah. Hanukkah began as a commemoration of a very, very big, bold event in Jewish history. The fact that we were able to overcome the Greeks, and that was symbolized by the fact that we put the Beit HaMikdash back into business by finding the oil, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu expands it with the miracle. No doubt there was a miracle here, but what's being observed is the facet of the fact that there was a great historic moment here. And to commemorate that, we will say Hallel and Hodayah. And the Rav suggested that perhaps the entire mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles as a formal mitzvah doesn't kick in until 200 years later, until the days of the post-destruction. And then a new idea is grafted onto Hanukkah, and that is like kindling the lights to remind us of some extension of the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles. Now, I want to be honest that the Rav spoke about this issue more than once, and he didn't always take this line. There were times that the Rav developed the idea that the candle lighting was it was part and parcel of the original Hanukkah. But the fact that he explored the possibility of Hanukkah candles not kicking in until after Churban Bayit Sheni, the destruction of Second Temple, is in itself very, very telling. I want to just give another thought that the Rav said on the end of Halakha Bet, that the candles were lit for 8 days, Achekatshu zeitim votzio shemen tahor, until they were able to press olives and, of course, transport them to Beit HaMikdash, and it took time. Some of the poskim mentioned that it was a four-day journey to the place where they would press olives and four-day journey back, and that's why there was 8 days. Because you may ask, why did the miracle stop after 8 days? But the obvious reason is because they now had fresh oil. So the Rambam is telling us, that defines the outer limit of the miracle. Now that we now have fresh oil and pure oil, we don't have to have a miracle. So the Rav expanded on this idea. The Rambam could have gotten away with saying, and they only had enough oil in the jar for 1 day, but they ended up lighting the menorah for 8 days. End of point, a sentence. And everybody would have understood that why didn't God continue the miracle to the 9th day? Because obviously they had oil. Why does the Rambam feel that it is important to state Achikachu Zeitim until they pressed the olives, Votzio Shemin Tahor, and they now had fresh, pure olive oil that was Tahor? Why did he have to say this where it would have been painfully obvious? Everyone would have understood that God wouldn't make a miracle for 8 days if the new oil would come in 20 days. What would they then do for the next 12 days? So the limits of the miracle were defined by when they would receive new oil. And if they could have gotten a stock of fresh oil after 6 days, then the miracle would have terminated after the 6th day. That seems to be pretty obvious. So the Rav said that this comes to teach us a very, very important halakha of Ein Somchin Al Hanes, not to rely on a miracle. That God will cooperate with miraculous deeds only in the event that human action cannot take any action whatsoever to save itself. A miracle is there where human action just falls to the wayside. The fact that they very much wanted to light the menorah, and they had oil for 1 day, and they decided, all right, 1 day we'll light the menorah. What happens the next 7 days? We don't have. I can tell you that I gave a bar mitzvah speech 56 years ago on this very, very halakha. And there is a halakha called Tumah Hutra B'Tzibur, that if the entire community are defiled, Tmeim, then we would be permitted to use impure oil to light in the Beit HaMikdash. And the question then becomes, why the miracle at all? It's not that they would not have lit candles for the success of 7 days. They just would have used Shemen Tameh, and it would have been halakhically acceptable under those circumstances. So there are many, many answers to that question. And one was supplied by the Rav's great-grandfather, the Rav's namesake, Rav Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik, the Rosh Hashiva of Valozhin, and then becomes the Rav in Slutsk, and later the Rav in Brisk. And he's known as the Beit HaLevi, the Sefer that he authors. And the Beit HaLevi suggested, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was impressed with the Mesirat Nefesh levels, the self-sacrifice that the Chashmonaim had for reestablishing the Beit HaMikdash. And because of that, gave us the mitzvah, a possibility that would be an upgrade. They could have lit the impure oil, but by having pure oil, it becomes a much better performance. So Kadosh Baruch Hu kicks in the idea of the Hidur mitzvah, the adornment of the mitzvah. It's going to be done on a higher level. And the Rav suggested that is why this mitzvah goes hand in hand with the concept of Hidur. We use the word Mahadrin. And I always kibitz with people. The only place in Shas, in the entire Gemara, that the phrase Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, is used, is right here in Masechet Shabbat with regard to Hanukkah candles. The Gemara says that all you really need, and this was the original institution, is light one candle per night, irrespective of how many members of the family. So all you need for the entire Hanukkah is 8 candles. Each night, one candle. But then came a level of Hidur. And the level of Hidur was to take into consideration the number of members of the family. So if there were 6 members of the family, so on night 1, the person would light 6 candles. On night 2, he would light 6 candles. On night 3, he would light 6 candles. And on night 8, he would light 6 candles. This was the upgrade, not just to light one candle, but to light a corresponding number of candles to the members of his family. And then comes a higher level called Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, a higher level of Hidur Mitzvah, and that is to take the day of Hanukkah into consideration as well. And here you have the famous dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How do we do this? Do we start with 8 and work our way down to 1? Or do we start with 1 and work our way up to 8? The minhag, the custom of the Sfaradim today, is that there's only 1 Hanukkah menorah, or as we call it here in Hebrew, a Chanukiah, for the whole family. So on night 1, there's 1 candle, and night 2, there are 2 candles, and night 3, there are 3 candles, and night 8, there are 8 candles. But the Ramah actually adopted a position that has its roots of all things in the Rambam, that not only do we upgrade in terms of the day, but we also upgrade in terms of the members of the family. So according to the Rambam, if you have 10 people in the family, so on night 1, you light 10 candles, on night 2, you light 20 candles, by the 8th night, you light 80 candles. That's what the Rambam really understands. But you have this concept of Hidur exponentially. So why is that so? And the Rav said, because there was Hidur mitzvah involved in the Mesirat Nefesh levels of the Chashmonaim, and they weren't satisfied with using impure oil, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu cooperates with them and allows them to have pure oil for the success of 7 days. And hence, the halakha builds this hidur into the fabric of the very mitzvah, and it's called Mahadrin and Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. And what I quipped about is, jokingly, is that while in Chazal, in the Gemara, the only time that Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin is used is in this context. Just this afternoon, I had some pizza with my wife in one of the locations in Yerushalayim, and I always took a peek at the Hechsher, the Tudat Hechsher, and guess what? This pizza was Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, and I always laugh because Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin was never said about cottage cheese, it was never said about pizza, it was said about lighting of Hanukkah candles. That's where the mitzvah is really done. So you have this idea, Acha Kachu Zeitim V'Zeo Shemen Tahor, is only until the possibility existed to bring natural oil, then there was a miracle, which means you are not allowed to rely on a miracle. But as long as there's human action, possible, then you have to do what you have to do. And the Rav felt that this can be snuffed out of this phrase, Achikachu Zeitim, Votzio Shemen Tahor. If just glancing a little further down, so one of the big issues that are raised is the issue is really, why do we have 8 days Hanukkah? It should only be 7 days because 1 day of oil they had. The author of that question is Rabbi Yosef Karo, famous Beit Yosef. Again, today, people, when they say Beit Yosef, they don't always mean Rabbi Yosef Karo's addendum to the tour, which becomes the forerunner of his own Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo. Today, there's even a Hashgacha, one of the kashrus agencies in Israel, is called Beit Yosef. So people, when they think Beit Yosef, they're thinking about the burgers bars that has the Hashgacha from Beit Yosef. But Beit Yosef is the classic work of Rabbi Yosef Karo. If you would meet up with Rabbi Yosef Karo and give him a big Yerasher Koch for his Shulchan Aruch, I think he'd be very insulted. Because the Shulchan Aruch wasn't his big work. It was just a digest of the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef is encyclopedic. He takes all the relevant views from the Middle Ages, from the Rishonim, and he brings it down to some type of halacha lemaseh, practical application. And in Shulchan Aruch, he just abbreviates all this. So this was not his main work, the Shulchan Aruch. The Torah was his main work. And in the Torah, he asked that question about why are there 8 days of Hanukkah where 1 day of oil they had. I saw a book recently in the Geula section of Yerushalayim in a bookstore, and the sefer was 1,000 answers to the question of the Beit Yosef. Now, I thought I knew something. I know about 5 or 6 answers to the question of the Beit Yosef. I didn't know that there were 1,000 answers. And basically what this author does, he culls all kinds of books and all kinds of talks that Rabbanim and Rosh Hashiv gave. And, you know, today there's a big thing that if a person was Rosh Hashiva or Rav, the audience is expecting a chidush, something novel. So you have this great challenge. You have this great question of the Beit Yosef. And you see that 10, 11, 12, 14, 20 other people responded, but you're going to say something new. And this business of saying something new, it's an expansion of Torah. Did Rabbi Yosef Karo have any of these ideas in mind? Most probably not. But nevertheless, the fellow was able to put together a book of 1,000 answers to the famous question of Rabbi Yosef Karo. But there are some classic answers. And one of the classic answers is that, let's not forget that there was a story here. And the story is the military victory. So in the Birkei Yosef, which is the Chida, he says that we should remember the Laila HaRishon Mishuma Nitzachon, source number 5, underlined. The first night is not because of the miracle. The first night, there was no miracle. They had a jar of oil, so they lit the jar of oil. The miracle part begins on day 2, and the miracle extends for 7 nights. So we have 7 nights of Hanukkah, but we'll also make Hanukkah on the first day because of the military victory. Now, this is important. Number one, in the days of Bayit Sheni, Second Temple era, as I already mentioned, in the Megillat Ta'anit, there's no small number of Chagim, of Yamim Tovim, commemorating all kinds of military victories. So military victory demands a type of Yom Tov. And therefore, I dismiss wholeheartedly, you know, those who think that in our days, whether it's the 5th of Iyar or the 28th of Iyar for the establishment of Medinat Yisrael and the Six-Day War, that some people claim, well, we should make Yom Tov because of a military victory, that's nonsense. We do make Yom Tov for a military victory, and we ought to. No doubt we should. And Chazal say that the Chizki HaMelech miraculously won a war, and he didn't say Shira, he didn't sing Hallel, and he lost the opportunity of perhaps being the Mashiach. So for a military victory, there's good room, good reason to have a day of a Yom Tov. So Delilah HaRishon Mishum HaNitzachon. So that's one answer, classic answer. But there are also other answers, and that is that even on day 1, it was a miracle because instead of the oil burning its full part, and full part can be also divided into 8/8. If you divide the oil into eighths, so 8/8 is a full, is a whole. So it didn't burn 8/8. It only burned 1/8 on night 1. And the second night it burned 1/8. So even on day one or night one, you have a miracle. And the miracle was that a fraction of that which should have burned, burned, and so on. Some want to say that they actually burned out completely, but the next morning, miraculously, the jug was filled up and they had oil for the subsequent days. On that kind of an answer, the Rav quoted his grandfather, Rav Chaim from Brisk, that halachically that couldn't work. And we know that in Tanakh, we have another episode of a nespach shemen, of an oil expanding. It's the haftarah for Parshat Vayera. It's in Malachim Bet Perek Dalet. The Isha Achat Mibnei Anaviyim Tzaka El Elisha Lemor Abdecha Ishimei. There the woman whose husband was a prophet and he died, and she was destitute, and the collectors were coming to already take her children away and selling them off to slaves. And she's begging Elisha for some type of assistance. And he asks, well, do you have any, what do you have in the house? She doesn't have much, but she has a jar of oil. And he says that they should go to the neighbors and collect the dishes and bottles and pans, whatever they can do. And then she should start pouring the oil that she has into all the other pots and pans. And they all start filling up with oil, tremendous amount of oil. So the quantity of oil multiplies exponentially there. And then she's able to go take that oil and sell it on the open market. We pay our debtors. And there was leftover. The yichyu benotar. She was able to live from the change that was left over. So there was a nespach shemen. There was no miracle. No yom tov was ever made for that. And Rav Chaim from Brisk said that that's not what the Hanukkah story was all about. It wasn't that a certain quantity of oil expanded times 8. Because if that would have happened, then from the second day onward, that oil would have been disqualified to light in the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash, as the Torah tells us, V'yikhu elecha shemen zayit zach katit lama'or. It's found in Parshat Tetzaveh and repeated again in Parshat Emor. Shemen zayit zach. It has to be pure olive oil that's squeezed out the first droplets, and means it has to be natural oil. Only natural oil can serve as the fulfillment of the mitzvah of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. And because if you suggest that the miracle was the expansion of the oil, then we have miraculous oil. And miraculous oil is disqualified. And hence what Rav Chaim suggested occurred was the oil did not expand, but multiplied in concentration, in terms of its quality. It became a higher grade oil. It was the same natural oil for the entire duration of the 8 days, except because of its concentration that miraculously became times 8, it burnt that much slower and lasted for 8 days. And this comes to teach us that the miracle was a qualitative and not a quantitative miracle. This the Rav suggested from his grandfather, Rav Chaim. But just to round out the issue of the separating of the story, we get to the brachot. So when we say the brachot, so our custom is to say two brachot, not custom, it's mentioned in the Gemara, that we have the bracha of the Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, and then we have the bracha She'asa Nisim Lavoteinu, and then the first night we have Shechiyanu. So let's just put Shechiyanu on the side, because that's not a Hanukkah issue per se. But we have the three brachot, and the other nights we have the two brachot. Fine. How do we do it? So in Shulchan Aruch it says, Hamadlik Belel Rishon, on the first night, we say three brachot, Ladlik Ner Chanukah, Shasa Nisim, and Shechiyanu. And then the next line is, Bilel Rishon Ve'elach, Madlik Shtayim. From the subsequent nights, we make the two brachot, Lahadlik and Shasa Nisim. The Ramah follows up here, Ramah Shezalis. V'yivarech kol ha-brachot kodim shiatchil lahadlik. You should make both brachot before you start lighting the candles. Now, this is now an issue. There is a book that was also authored in the days of the Geonim in the 7th century called Masechet Sofrim. And in the 20th chapter of Masechet Sofrim, it reads that we have the bracha lahadlik ner shel Chanukah, and then we have the paragraph Hanerot halanu anu madlikim al anisim val nifloot al chuot al nechamot that whole section that many of us at home sing it. It explains something about the Hanukkah candles. And in the Masechet Sofrim, it reads that only after the reciting of the Hanerot Halalu do you go on to say the second bracha, Sha'asa Nisim Laboteinu Bayamim Lahem Basman Hazeh, that God performed the miracles. The first bracha is on the lighting, Hadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah, which means you make the bracha right before you light the candle, what we call over lasiatan. But according to the Masechet Sofrim, we delay the bracha of Sha'asa Nisim, but we say it after Hanerot Halalu. Now that's not our custom. The custom that the Rama suggests is that we should say the bracha. He says make both brachot before the candle, not only Hadlik Ner, but also Sha'asa Nisim, and the Sha'asa Nisim should be a bracha also over la'asiyatan, immediately prior to the performance of the mitzvah. Yet the Mishnah Brura says something slightly different. He says as follows. The reason that it says we should make the bracha before lighting in source number 9, the be'inan we need sheyeh brachot over la'asiyatan, hidlik ner Chanukah v'shachach lebarech al hadlakata. If somebody lit the candles and forgot to make the bracha on the lighting, v'rak kodem shehidlik kulan, he didn't finish lighting all of them, and he didn't make the bracha, so yesh lo lebarech, he could still make the bracha. But then he says, she'im niskor la'achar shehidlik kulam, if he remembers after he lit all the candles, then ein lebarech bracha birkat lahadlik. But rak birkat she'asa nisim, l'chein she'asa she'achiyanu yesh lebarech. Fine. But now the Orach HaShulchan says something more interesting. Achar shehidlik haner rishon, says the Orach HaShulchan, after you light the first candle, and he's assuming that you've made the brachot already, yomar haneret halalu onam adikim, and you have the whole nusach that we say, alanisim balatun flot shasim alaseinu, and so on, so on, so on, so on, so on. But then he says, the od sheomer zeh, while you're saying the haneret halalu, yigmor ha-halaka, you should complete the lighting of the candles. And that is the Pishum Hanes. What the Orach HaShulchan is suggesting here is a type of compromise. Not to say Hanerot Halalu after you've lit all your candles, the way the Rama seems to suggest, but rather to light the candle after you say the Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. And then you start saying Hanerot Halalu. And as you're saying Hanerot Halalu, you're lighting the candles, and you have just said Sha'asa Nisim Laboteinu, which means the Orach HaShulchan is not suggesting to do like the Masechet Sofrim. He's not suggesting to delay the Sha'asa Nisim. He's saying say the Sha'asa Nisim, but already get into saying Hanerot Halalu. Attach to the bracha of Sha'asa Nisim the explanation of why you're doing this. Hanerot Halalu Anam Adikim. Why are we lighting this? And this goes back to the very, very first Rambam, why the Rambam includes the history. Because the mitzvah has two component parts. It has the part of the story of the Nerot and the Beit HaMikdash, and that's why we have the Hanukkah candles per se, but we also have the facet of the Pirsum HaNes, and the Nes here is the story, and we have to get out the story. How do we integrate into the fabric of the story, this whole idea? By saying the Hanerot Halalu, as we are continuing to light the candles. Ba'od she'omer zeh yigmor ha'adlaka, v'zehu pirsum, v'shum pirsum inisa. Of course, if you don't say it, lo yikev, you're not going to lose the mitzvah. Rambam doesn't even mention this at all, even though it's all mentioned in Masechet Sofrim. The nusach of Hanerot Halalu, the Orach HaShulchan is well aware of the fact where it comes from, but he does not state what this Masechet Sofrim suggested to delay the saying of Sha'asa Nisim until after the saying of the Hanerot Halalu. What he is suggesting is we can somehow say the Hanerot Halalu first and get in the Hanerot Halalu as we are still in the process of lighting the candles. So you have here clearly a statement that we should be understanding, we should comprehend the fact that this mitzvah is a little complex. on the one hand, we have the story of the candles. On the other hand, we have the story, the historical story. And we have to get both of them in, into the mitzvah itself. And that's why the Rambam says, mitzvah ner Chanukah mitzvah chavivah hi yad ma'od. Very, very precious mitzvah. Tzarich adam lizaher ba, kedei lahodia hanes ulosif b'shvach ha'el bodia lo al hanisim shasa lano. You have to use the opportunity to publicize the nest. And that's why the halakha is that if one lights indoors and there are no other people in the family there to even absorb and listen and look and see the lights, and he's far from a door or far from a window to the outside, and then he feels maybe he'll take the candles and that are lit already and move it to the window or move it to the outdoors. This is the whole discussion of the Gemara, Hadlaka osa mitzvah or Hanacha osa mitzvah. Does the placing of the candles in its proper place the mitzvah, or is it lighting in the proper place? And the halakha is that it has to be lit in the proper place, that the position of the Nerot, of the Chanukiah, has to be already in place, that it will publicize the miracle. And I will stress, the miracle is publicized through the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles, not by putting on an electric menorah, not by putting on signs all over the house, Happy Hanukkah. That is not the Pirsum Hanes that Chazal were talking about. They were talking about using the Nerot Hanukkah as the medium to publicize the miracle. And this is what we should be doing. I will just conclude by saying that growing up in Chutz La'aretz until age 26 in New York City, I never, ever saw anybody light Hanukkah candles by the outside door. And people explained to me, because you wouldn't see a menorah there the next morning. People were nervous. And already in the days of the Gemara, Hanukkah candles gave trouble to Am Yisrael. It was fuel for anti-Semitic activity, and the Gemara already gives us the ability to light candles indoors when that happens. We had trouble. We definitely had trouble throughout the years, and it's not an accident that there's the 25th of Kislev and the 25th of December that sometimes coincide, and it hasn't always been a rosy picture for Am Yisrael on Hanukkah. Here, today in Eretz Yisrael, there are many, many people who have built into their outdoor walls a little enclave with a box to protect from the wind, and the Hanukkah candles are literally lit outside, the way Chazal talked about originally in Masechet Shabbat. But we still fulfill our mitzvah anyway by doing it by the window, the opposite public domain, or even if need be, indoors, provided that somebody else is still awake, and then we can still say the bracha. And if nobody's awake, then we can light it without a bracha, because there's got to be somebody else to be impressed with the story through the Nerot. And in a word, this is these are some of the ideas that the Rav developed in his various shurim on Hanukkah. And the Mi'at Hashem, in the next 2 weeks, we will continue with different aspects of the Rav's thinking on Hanukkah. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. There are a couple little questions in the chat box if you want to take a look. Really, I guess the first one you kind of already dealt with, the first halacha, the intro, the background, why the history becomes part of the story. And then about Greeks, Greek was a spoken language during Beit Sheni. Okay. I don't know if that's true. I think it was Aramaic, but
the Jews spoke Aramaic, but Greek was clearly a language. Greek culture was there, no question about it, no question. And so much so that it's likely that when the Mishnah in Masechet Yoma speaks about people, I'm sorry, Masechet Bikurim, who came to Beit HaMikdash and didn't know how to read Hebrew, and they had to have a Bal Kairei to read the section of five psukim that to us we're very familiar with through on Seder night, we say these psukim, it indicates how strong the foreign language impact was on general society. And you could have a scenario, as the Mishnah in Yoma tells us, of a Kohen Gadol who didn't know Hebrew either, and he couldn't read the sections of Tanakh at nighttime. Very sad statement in Beit Sheni, where you could have purchased the position of being a Kohen Gadol, and it's not exactly what Aaron a Kohen thought would become of the Kohuna Gedola. And yes, the war of the Maccabees was not just a war against Greeks, but it was against Jews who were Hellenists, and they were out to purge the Jewish people from Greek culture. And they were partially successful. Partially.
If I may, okay, take the last question. Are you saying someone who lives alone should not make the brachas?
If there's no view to the outside, if person's home alone and at the requisite time and there are people outdoors and you light by the window, of course you make a bracha. If it's late at night, if it's midnight, you haven't lit candles yet, and there's nobody on the street any longer and nobody else is awake, then you'd light without the bracha.
All right. If I may make a comment on the first halacha, why the Rambam gives history. So I remember Rabbi Berglass, I'm sure you know Rabbi Meir Berglass, who taught me for 4 years in high school. So I remember he told us, I believe he quoted the name of the Avnei Nezer, but I've never seen it inside, that the Rambam was basically puskening that the Maccabees were good guys because as opposed to, let's say, to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who left them up the Mishnah, because the Maccabees eventually, what came with them is not, you know, historically not good. They took over the Beit HaMikdash as they took over the running of the country. Kohanim, you know, that belongs to Shevet Yehuda. And therefore, there's a lot of negativity towards the Maccabees. And that may be why Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi didn't include Hanukkah in the Mishnah. And therefore, the Rambam is writing against that notion, and he's saying what the Maccabees did, that we should view them in a more positive light. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Okay, so first of all, with regard to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and perhaps excommunicating the Maccabees from the Mishnah, I have a whole share on that. We're not going to do that now. Rav Neria Zatzal wrote a whole paper on this, and again, and Rav Goren responded. There are eight examples in the Mishnah of the mention.
Right, but they're all in passing. Each one of them is in passing. They don't talk about it at all, really.
That's correct. It's not discussed. And it is possible that if we fall back on what the Rambam says in his Perish HaMishnah on Masechet Minachot, the fourth parish, where he asked the question, how come there's no discussion in the Mishnah about Talis and Tefillin? Because he said they were so known to people that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi didn't have to put that material into the Mishnah. And Abba Hanukkah was so popular that level of going through the bold by blow didn't have to be there. But I want to comment about what you mentioned earlier about the Chashmonaim being Kohanim. So the Ramban in Parshat Vayechi really takes a stab at the Maccabean dynasty. And he says that they did a great thing at the beginning, but should have invited the descendants of the Davidic line to take over. And as we know in Israeli politics, no prime minister hands it over and to the next one. The first one who's going to do it is going to be Naftali Bennett in a year and a half to hand over the reins of power to someone else. So I think we're going to have to say Hallel that day because it's going to be the first time in this Jewish history.
Shamir and Shimon Peres, no?
That's correct. Shamir and Peres did it as well. You're right. You're right. I stay correct.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
You're right. It did happen. The rotation did happen successfully. That is correct.
Yeah,
that's correct. But I want to point out that the Chazra Malchut Yisrael Yetta Matayim Shana, in the Rambam's language, it's not only not negative, it's more than Parv. It's a positive statement. And I try to explain to people with regard to the current Israeli situation of the last 72 years, whatever government it was. So it's not perfect. It's not Malchut Beit David, but it's better than Galut. And Rambam understood that. That having the Maccabean dynasty for 200 years with Hordus and with Yanai HaMelech, I never understood why we have a street called Yanai HaMelech who drove the Sanhedrin out of Eretz Israel and so on. But if you know where Yanai Street is, it's a short, small road that's crooked. And I figured perfect. The municipality picked the right street to memorialize Yanai HaMelech. But as opposed to Shlom Tzion HaMalka, she gets a highway. Down in the middle of Yerushalayim, she deserved it, and Heleni Amalka, and so on. So the Rambam has a positive take on the Maccabean dynasty, and that is extremely important.
The other explanation he gave, which is also fascinating, is that, of course, the Rambam in his introduction writes that you only need two books in your library, a Tanakh and the Mishnah Torah. So you wouldn't know about Hanukkah. The other holidays, I know, but if you take the Rambam literally, that's what he means. So you would have no knowledge of Hanukkah. So since the Rambam is basically just commenting on Tanakh, he had to give you the history of Hanukkah. It's a fascinating approach. Anyways, I think he said that in the name of the Rav. I don't know if you ever heard the Rav give that explanation.
Okay, that's possible. I can tell you that by Rav Chaim, the Rav's grandfather, there are also only two books, a Gemara and a Rambam.
Okay. So at least somebody held the, but he put the Gemara in the middle. The Rambam wanted to do away with the Gemara, but that's for another whole.
The Rav once commented to me in a humoristic note, he said that we all know that the Gemara just came to explain the Rambam. And of course, we know.
Of course, one of my teachers, that's the most difficult of all the Rambams. You know, every Rashiva has to have for Emperor a Shvera Rambam. So here, the most difficult Rambam of them all is that we don't need the Gemara. You know, but
we're gonna find out when my second book comes out called Al Kanfei Nisharim on the Rambam. That many of these difficult Rambams, the solution lies in methodology, not so much in Svara and logic. So that's next on the drawing boards.
All right, that's at Harvard when you're there in the few months. Okay, very, very nice. Okay, nice to see you. Okay, tomorrow, Kol Tuv. Okay, please go see you next week. Tomorrow, Rav Carmel finishes his Shir Bivrit, David HaMelech, Malchut Yisrael, B'David HaMelech, Zeh Yashir, Shishiv Acharon Shalom, Al Nosei Azot, Zeh Machar, B'Shtayim V'Reva, B'Eastern Time Zone, Eastern Standard Time. And then tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolok, of course, continuing his series, How Tanakh was put together. And then Thursday, Shuli Mishkin and Parsha by Joel Finkelstein, Rabbi Joel Finkelstein in Memphis, Tennessee. And then my shiur on Friday morning on the Siddur. So we look forward to learning with you. Invite your friends and all the best. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day. Thank you very much. Okay, Laila Tov.